Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Roundtable Network News. Today we have a very special show we're going to start doing. I'm your weather franchise player, Double B Babble, and I am joined by Double J, Josh James. And Josh, today we're going to dig deep into a story that happened a while ago. And I want to start this docuseries because I want to start highlighting some things from the past. And yeah. I want to talk about Bruiser Brody.
The man behind me, the man in the background. One of the best guys, one of the best and terrifying wrestlers I've ever seen in my life.
We're talking about dominating Japan, you know, just dominating Puerto Rico. And that's where we're going to stop right there, because courtesy of our friend Matt Legit over at Testosterone Overload, we're going to go ahead and we're going to share a story about Bruiser Brody. Let's go ahead and let's pull this up and let's get into the action. Let's go ahead and start this out.
Let's do this.
We have a very special presentation to bring to you tonight. An interview with Barbara Goodish, the widow of professional wrestling legend Bruiser Brody. For those of you not familiar with Bruiser Brody, he was born Frank Goodish, June 18th, 1946, in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. He graduated from Warren High School in Detroit, Michigan, where he was All-State in both football and basketball. Frank went on to play college ball at West Texas University. While working as a sports journalist at the San Antonio Express newspaper, Goodish was trained to wrestle by legendary Dallas promoter Fritz Von Erich and began his career working in Florida under his real name. He would later be rechristened Bruiser Brody by the one and only Vince McMahon Sr. He would win his first championship, the NWA Western States Heavyweight title, on October 17, 1975, in the Funk family's Amarillo
championship that I know very well.
At 6'5", with an unusual, almost frightening look, he became known throughout the world for his wild antics in the ring. In the States, he's renowned for his battles with Kamala the Ugandan Giant and his brutal, bloody feud with Abdullah the Butcher. In Japan, he became widely respected for his hard-hitting singles matches and his tough-as-nails tag team with partner Stan the Lariat Hansen. On July 16, 1988, before a match at Bayamon, Puerto Rico for the World Wrestling Council, he was asked by Jose Huertas Gonzalez, the booker and a fellow wrestler, to step into the locker room shower to talk. Brody entered a shower stall with Gonzalez, better known as Invader Number One. And a few moments later, screaming was heard. Tony Atlas raced to the shower, only to find Bruiser Brody bent over, holding his stomach and bleeding, while Gonzalez was holding a knife. Due to a packed stadium inside and heavy traffic outside, paramedics couldn't get to Brody for close to an hour. Sadly, he died. During a trial the following year, a jury accepted Gonzalez's claim that he was acting in self-defense, a decision believed by many to be a miscarriage of justice. Atlas was never recalled to testify, and the knife used by Gonzalez to murder Frank Goodish mysteriously disappeared.
So many conspiracy theories about
that. Many people, both in and out of the business, believe this was part of a cover-up. Even though it's been 28 years since the death of Bruiser Brody in Puerto Rico, fans throughout the world will not let his legacy disappear. No matter where you go,
more like 35 years.
From the United States to Australia to Japan, fans still talk about Bruiser Brody. I hope you fans out there enjoy the few moments we got to spend with Barbara Goodish, Bruiser Brody's wife, talking about his life and his legacy.
It was quite an interesting story. I was working in a hotel in Sydney, Australia, and all the overseas wrestlers would be staying at that hotel. To me, they were just all like my brothers, because this was before computers, this was before the internet. So when I was working the front desk, I would give them all their mail and they would show me their letters, they would show me the photographs of their kids, and we would talk about the families. Because they didn't have much touch. When they're in a strange country, there wasn't a lot of communication. So I became pretty good friends with a lot of them because I was just a friend. I was safe. They knew they could be honest with me. So it was just like a big, another big family. One night I happened to be working late and they had come back from a match, and there was about 12 of them. And or at that point, Frank had been maybe in the hotel or probably about 6 weeks and just talking away, just becoming friends. And we went up to, in fact, it was a Texas gentleman that owned the hotel, and he had like a piano bar called the Bourbon and Beef up at, you know, up the street. So they came back. I was leaving the hotel about 11 o'clock and they came back from their matches and they said, well, why don't you just come up for a drink with us? And I'm talking about Andre the Giant, the Mitches, so it was quite a diverse crowd. Yeah, so we went up there as the night progressed, because it was already starting off at 11 o'clock. One by one, they would get off from the table and say, we'll be right back. Well, this happened several times. Then all of a sudden, there was only three of us left, which was Killer Kyle Croft, which was one of my friends too. And then he gets up and says, I'll be right back. Well, he never came back. Of course, that just left Frank and me, and we just sat there and talked till like 5 o'clock in the morning. But I found out later it was a setup, that he didn't know how to get me by myself, so he'd set up all the boys so that I would feel comfortable, so that in the finish there was only going to be him and me, and that is probably how it all started. You know, when you have a relationship, if you become friends first, and at least for something else, you know, you're not trying to be somebody else, you're just yourself. And so he knew me as myself. He was doing Australia and New Zealand, so he was pretty much in Australia, in Sydney, at least a couple of times a week. So that's kind of so, and he was there, I'd say, for a period of about 9 months or something. So we got to know, we got to know each other pretty much in that 9 months. And of course, everybody was saying, they're just going to leave. I mean, don't be silly. You know, he's going to get on a plane and you'll never see him again. Frank kind of had a little bit of a disagreement sometimes with promoters. He comes back one Friday night. He was leaving the country the next day. He put his pay on the table, not a word. He said, this will be enough. He said, I'd like you to come with me. Would you, come with me? No promises, no nothing. But sometimes you don't need it. You can understand somebody. And I knew he was serious because he was very tight with his money. And here it was, this wad of cash for me to cover me to come to America. And he didn't know. I mean, I knew that he trusted me because I could have been somebody that just kept the money and not even get on a plane. In life, sometimes opportunities, you have to take opportunities. And I thought, I will never get to see America. So I got a round trip ticket and kept my fingers crossed. A week later, I had to tie up, 10 years of my life. Got on the plane, biting my fingers, said, is he going to be there when I get to the airport? Of course, this was when you got off the plane and everybody, there was no security back in those days. And the minute I got on my plane, the Hare Krishnas were meeting the plane. So, got the other plane to San Antonio. Got off the plane, sort of feeling, because you never know. I thought, what if he's not there? What am I going to do? But sure enough, here he was. And I got through the gate. Here he was with a big smile on his face. And I guess that was the story, because I'm still in America. Sometimes when he was working Fritz von Erich's territory and he was driving and it was close to the house, he would take me and his son Jeff. I mean, Jeff was only small. And a lot of times he would go to the wrestling match, and like if it was like in Corpus Christi, he would go to the wrestling match and me and Jeff would go and walk around the town and look at the water and then come back to the match. And a lot of times they were really small that he would have to change outside. There wasn't even a dressing room for them. They were changing in the street. We'd pull up and he'd get up and hide, and he'd be changing in the street to go to the building. Sometimes he would leave, and it might be 4 weeks before I even heard from him, especially when he went over to Japan, because those were very long trips. But I think he knew I could handle it. He said, I knew when I saw you that you could probably handle my lifestyle. I'm not going to say it was easy, because especially when his son was born, I mean, he was on the road. He was the last person to know because he had left. And his son was born, and he was somewhere between Kansas City and St. Louis. And then I think when he got to where he was going, there was a note at the hotel saying that he had a son. Then I had to keep saying, I can't go home. I've got nobody to take me home until he could get back into town on the Monday. We flew on the plane. He got in about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock that night. And then he had to leave again at 9 o'clock the next morning. So, yes, it was a hard life, but you manage. Wrestling is not all glamorous. There's a lot of hard work.
I literally been saying that for years. I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Oh, those are some very good things.
He would go into the airport and you'd get out of the car. And Harry would be dad and father. He would go through the airport doors, take his hair out, and I could see the transformation from dad, father, to Bruiser Brody. He actually became Bruiser Brody when he left the family behind. He became the character that he was. And then when he came back, it was the transformation the other way. He'd be Bruiser Brody on this side of the window or the gate, and he would come out and he would just be father again and husband. He knew how to define the two. He used it, it was a business to him, and he never lost sight of who he really was. I think he was just a gentle giant. I think he was, that's why people, I think, remember him, because when they met him, they couldn't believe, they expected this big, strong man, and here he was, this very softly spoken, gentle person. And even today, I have people call or, you know, message me and things, and they tell me about times that they met him when they were just, they weren't into wrestling, they were just a little child at the airport. And he would see them hiding behind their, you know, their parents' legs. And he said he would go over and talk, you know, bend down and talk to them. And they said their whole life they realized you can't judge a book by its cover. Flying into Puerto Rico, I was grateful. The one thing I was grateful for was there was a Canadian lady, Nancy, who translated everything for me, who helped me so much. Without her, I really don't know how I would have managed. The one thing I had said, because the Puerto Rican people were so kind to me, and I wanted them to know that I don't define the people just because of the actions of one man, because it was a tragedy. If anybody is interested, it is in the book. It was very therapeutic to write the story, and I think that was one of the things I think that helped me the most, because some things in life you kind of block out, and writing the book kind of helped me get it all out of, you know, sometimes putting things on paper just really helps. So a lot of that time I had blocked out. You know, I think when tragedy happens, you go into another phase, it's like, which I think is what is our protection to get through tragedies that everybody has in life. This is such a unique business, and that we're all family, but a lot of people outside the business, you have to be a whole different person because they don't understand. It's a family business, and when everything happened, I lost that family. So coming to like something like this, like CAC this year, and being with everybody it makes my heart good because it's a family. And then I go back to my ordinary life, which I can't talk about it because nobody else understands. And I think you can be free. People will just come up and shake my hand and say, oh, your husband, you know, we still remember, and they remember things that they have seen over the time. But when you're around your wrestling family, there are no strangers. Well, a lot of people had asked me, and I was totally against the idea. And Larry Matisak, who worked with Frank in St. Louis, who was the booker, who was a very, very good friend, who Frank trusted so much, he approached me. But just before he had approached me, I had gone to visit my son, and he said, put in Dad's name in the internet, because this was just when the internet was coming and hadn't had no access to internet. So I typed in Bruiser Brody, and I was totally shocked. So much of it was untruth. You know, it was so much lies and just what people have made up. And I thought, well, there's two people that know the truth. Larry knows the truth about the wrestling business, and I know the truth about the home business. So, and when Larry approached me after that, I said, there's only two people that can get the truth out there, and that's you and me. And that was the reason we went and wrote the book. It's called Brody, The Triumph and Tragedy of Wrestling's Rebel. So appreciate that everybody is keeping his memory so much alive that it's quite astonishing just how much. And now with YouTube, and people that have never seen him wrestle will tell me, oh, I saw your husband's match between Ric Flair, and they remember. And of course the Japanese, he was so big in Japan that even the Japanese will come and say and post pictures. And because of, you know, Facebook messaging, I get to see pictures of him from Japan, and it shows me even sometimes a different side, especially in Japan. I mean, here he is in the gardens, or here he is in the walk, or here he is on a boat.
I love that picture.
It's showing me a personal side that I haven't seen. He seems to be so alive.
A lot of
they even have his own
sort of amazing history right there.
Bruce and Brody, yeah. Hardcore before hardcore. People post, and all these people, it's just wonderful. And I keep track because I do appreciate when people message me and they send me such nice messages. I always will respond because I am grateful that they still remember him. So I want to tell them that I thank them, because, you know, this business, without all the fans, this is what the business is, and that's what he always tried to give the fans the best night of their lives. And I think that's why he is still remembered today.
Shout out to Matthew Mertz for allowing us to share this with you guys.
That was awesome. I enjoyed that.
You know, it's like I said, man, this was an honor and a privilege to be able to share this with everyone here on the Roundtable Network News. The Bruiser Brody story, Wrestling with Murder, Legit Wrestling. Thank you very much for allowing us to have access to that. We will be sharing a lot more from Legit Wrestling later on down the line. There's a lot of stuff we got going on. We got a pretty, I missed one of our Paul Orndorff story. We've got a story with Martha Hart. There's so much amazing things that we're going to be doing every week here live on the Roundtable Network News. Remember, guys, go like, click, and subscribe. We'll see you guys, and we'll see you. Have a great day.